CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Alice Fullwood of The Economist magazine, the Wall Street correspondent, to speak of a special publication inside The Economist magazine about banking. That's right. I'm told in the course of this explication that nobody likes banking. So grit your teeth. Here we are, brave new world of banking. Alice, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. Nobody likes banking. And after reading through your essay, I would say at this point, not even banking likes banking because we're in a transition that isn't obvious. I want to start with the fundamentals of banks. Once upon a time, the biggest banks were in London. So it was not only one country, it was one empire. Was that a better way of doing banking than we do now, having it all in one place, everybody knowing each other? Now you indicate that the biggest banks are in New York, Beijing, and Tokyo. Is that is not as desirable? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. You know, there definitely was a strength in the sort of old model of banking that sort of ran in Walter Badgett's day in the sort of late 19th century. And the point that he makes in his essays is that all of the capital was in London. So if you were someone in need of a loan or any kind of investment financing, you sort of knew where to go. You went to Lombard Street in London. That was where all of the big banks were. And he makes this point that the location of capital all in one place was a real strength for the Brits at that time. And he describes, you know, any business that needed funding or investment would not fail for lack of financing because Britain had these banks, whereas other countries didn't at that point. They didn't have that infrastructure in place. So, you know, that was the real heyday of British banking. Now, of course, every country across the world has developed its own banking sector. Lots of countries have their own sort of national champion banks who finance domestic businesses. And that's a really important process. I think it's, you know, good for the world in general that banking has spread from London across the world, even if it's not the best for Britain that everyone else has caught up.
I want to be positive here, forward looking, not asking questions about what can go wrong. The banking of London day, of Mr. Badger's day, was physical. You had a stack of pound notes. They were very large. They opened sort of like 9 by 11 sheets of paper. Now there is the digital. And if I understand your presentation in The Economist correctly, the digital has an advantage. It has a trail. But it also, that trail is a disadvantage because people can know who you are, where you are at any one time. Has banking accepted that digital is where they're all headed, or are there regrets that they'll no longer have physical possession of money?
So I don't think there are so much regrets per se, but it's more that the nature of banking has sort of fundamentally changed. So when you had physical banknotes or even physical gold, if you go back far enough, you know, the critical advantage that banks had is that they were the only ones that could hold on to deposits of that stuff. They could hold deposits of loans, they could hold deposits of banknotes, and therefore they had all the capital, they had all the funding for businesses. So any sort of customer who wanted any kind of loan or funding would have to go to the banks. Today, with digital money and digital deposits, the process by which people can provide loans is becoming a lot more fragmented. So the banks still have all the capital, but you have this whole ecosystem of payments providers, fintechs, etc., who are using their own advantage, which is that, you know, you interact with them all the time. They have a lot of data on you and who you are and what you do. And they can use that data to decide sort of the best people to lend to, and that can borrow from them. And, you know, working together with banks, you can therefore provide sort of funding in a sort of new and different way than in the past that doesn't give banks a sort of monopoly over financial services provision that it used to have in the past.
Right. It used to be called shadow banks. Now it's just everywhere. You include the wonderful Bob Hope joke that manages to humanize all this. Banks are people who will lend you money when you can prove you don't need it. And that is not the case of shadow banking now, of shadow banking or digital banking, because you say, and Alice, there's a feeling here we've stumbled into this. For example, you report that WeChat and Alipay didn't know they were going to be powerful when they started. They were seen as a convenient way for people who went on their websites to make purchases. Is it really that innocent that bankers did not see that once we go digital, there was no controlling it? It was going to go to anybody who could have a better and easier website with a lot of lollipops given out. Did they not understand that was coming?
I do think that there really is a sense in which, you know, payments used to not be that exciting, you know, especially when everyone was paying for things using paper checks and physical banknotes. You know, no one really had all of that insight and all of that information that comes with being the person that is involved in every transaction that an individual does every day. So, you know, you talk about these big tech companies, people like Ant Financial, which was born out of Alibaba, you know, the e-commerce site, or WeChat, which is a messaging service. You know, their businesses started by being the dominant provider of a service that you use every day. So e-commerce, maybe ride hailing, messaging. And once you provide that kind of service, it does become easy and useful to be also the service that people use to pay for those things. You embed payments. And then once you've embedded payments, you have this wealth of information, this wealth of access to somebody's financial situation. So you can offer them a mortgage. You can offer them a small business loan. Maybe you can offer them investments or insurance. And, you know, Ants has essentially sort of flourished into this business that collects fees for providing all of those financial services. And it is, you know, this huge, huge entity in China. And it's grown so quickly and become sort of so powerful that now, you know, regulators are becoming sort of very nervous about it as well.
Yes, regulators are nervous in every direction. I just wanted to know whether they were sitting around a room one day and a light went on and said, you know, if we do this, we'll take over the world. You know, that sort of plot. It seems that they backed into it, realizing that it was convenient. We have PayPal here in the U.S. There are a couple of other sites that you mention. This is now fintech, financial technology. Grab in Singapore and Mercado Pago in Latin America. Alipay we've mentioned and WeChat Pay in China. PayPal here. Are these understood by banks as competitors now? Or is this a convenience that has a lot of data that looks a whole lot like banking, but might also just be people's data that show up when you have an iPhone and you walk into a store, that kind of data? So how do banks regard these payment portals? Are they banks?
You know, there was a sense a few years ago from bankers that fintech, which is, you know, distinct from big tech, that if they ever sort of posed a real threat to the banking system, that, you know, you could probably just buy them. You could just do acquisitions. The problem with the competitive threat that people like Ant and PayPal or even Amazon, you know, Amazon is launching into sort of doing small business loans as well. The competitive threat that those businesses pose is so much more difficult to defend against because banks can't buy tech. They're not rich enough. So if you think that their sort of model of financial services provision is going to work very effectively, then, you know, it is this huge threat. But there are things that tech can't do that banks do, for example. So they can sell you a loan, or they can sell you a mortgage or a sort of portfolio of investments or whatever, and they can collect a fee on that, but they can't actually hold that asset. They don't have the balance sheet that banks have. You know, like I said, the strength of banks is that they have all of this funding from consumer deposits, and then they try and figure out who to lend it to or how to use it. Tech know who to lend to. They know who needs financial services products, but they don't necessarily have the balance sheet to back it up. So they partner either with banks, you know, a lot of customer deposits that are held on Alipay's platform are ultimately held in bank accounts, or they partner with capital markets. So they will take, you know, the loans that they create and maybe bundle them and sell them as securities to investors that want to hold those assets. And for most of history, you know, like I said, banks had all the capital, banks had all the funding. So tech would have had to work with banks. But increasingly, what you've seen with the sort of rich development of capital markets across the world is that actually investors now have just as much funding as banks. So banks and investors hold about half each of global financial assets. So tech is doing the front end service provision to individuals. And at the back end, banks are still holding on to some of those assets, but so are capital markets. And it becomes possible to think of this sort of world of financial services provisions in which the share that banks provide and hold just grows smaller and smaller over time.
I'm speaking to Alice Fullwood, the Wall Street correspondent for The Economist magazine, on a special section in The Economist about banking, where we are right now. You see, the word banking is disappearing as we're talking about it. Who has the money? Who has the data? What's more important? We're going to go, when we come back, to Silicon Valley. It is a revelation to me that Silicon Valley and banks are not friendly with each other. They're not even they're not even neighbors with each other. Silicon Valley is funded by something entirely different called intangible capital. Is that a good thing? Well, it works. This is CBSi on the World. I'm John Batchelor.